A Harvard lawyer has written one of the most detailed and revealing insights into the structure of our county law enforcement, and it is disturbing. It obliterates the false narratives we've been led to believe about our nation's history and the mythologies around the frontier county sheriff. I'm Mike Green, and you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Jessica Pishko has a JD from Harvard Law School and has been reporting on the legal and criminal justice system for a decade, with a focus on the political power of sheriffs since 2016. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Politico, The Atlantic, and other major media, and her new book is titled The Highest Law in the Land: How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Welcome to the JX, Jessica.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with your background and what led you to write this book.
You know, I grew up in Texas, and as a kid growing up, I always thought of sheriffs as, you know, white hat riding on a horse, something that I knew about but didn't know too many facts about. Eventually, as I began reporting on and working in the criminal legal system, I realized that sheriffs had a lot more power than I initially thought. So, for example, sheriffs are not only the only elected law enforcement officers, they also run jails. So they're in place at both sort of the front end, out there arresting and pulling over drivers, as well as on the back end, right, ensuring their safety inside jails, taking care of medical needs. And then as I began researching the book, I also realized that because sheriffs are elected, they play a really important political role, both locally, but also increasingly on a national level.
Well, before we get into the current power dynamics and ideology of a subset of the population of sheriffs today, let's talk about how racial hierarchy and the ideology of white supremacy and the law have long been intertwined. And what is posse comitatus?
So posse comitatus literally means power of the county. And for a long time, for sheriffs at least, it was basically how they did law enforcement. So, you know, there wasn't really formal courts or police structures. And what local sheriffs would do is they would summon up what they called a posse, which was basically every adult white male who had a firearm. And the posse would go and either look for whoever they were looking for, or let's say they were something like hunting down horse thieves, something in that range. Over time, this power has actually remained in the law. So many states actually still have posse comitatus laws on the books.
Now, I noticed you said they would round up white men. Talk about this ideology of racial hierarchy, the valuing and devaluing of humans by race, and white supremacy.
I think that when we think about white supremacy and sheriffs and policing in general, right, it really ties into a lot of thought ideas about who is a citizen and who has rights, right? So one of the reasons why the posse was always the white men was because those were the people who were allowed to have firearms, of course. And of course, we also know that, you know, throughout most of that time, Black Americans, many of them were either enslaved, or if they were not enslaved, they had a lot of laws. You know, they might be stopped or questioned even if they were free people. And we also know that, of course, during the 1800s, when the United States was establishing itself as a country, there were many wars, mostly as a result of removing Native Americans from their land, right? So there was a long process of removing Native Americans from their territory, moving them west, and then oftentimes either removing them again or engaging in genocide because Anglo-Saxon settlers were going across the country. So I think when we look at the role of sheriffs and the police, what we see is that the sheriff really served as a bastion of white supremacy, right? That the policing and the power of the sheriff and the violence used by sheriffs were largely against people who were not white to the benefit of those who were.
So the regions that We reach at JPR are Southern Oregon and Northern California, both of which are mostly rural, where sheriffs play an important role. In your book, you talk about a subset of the sheriff population known as constitutional sheriffs. What's the difference between a constitutional sheriff and a traditional sheriff?
I think the constitutional sheriffs, well, as a group, constitutional sheriffs define themselves as sheriffs who believe that they only need to enforce the U.S. Constitution. So that's where the Constitution part comes in. They see themselves as the ultimate deciders of what laws are constitutional and what laws are not. And in everyday life, what this essentially translates to is they decide what laws they will enforce and what laws they will not enforce, regardless of what state government or Congress or the president or the Supreme Court says. And most of the time, we have seen that a lot of the laws that they choose not to enforce include gun regulation, right? Especially in Oregon and rural areas, this is one of the most important laws that constitutional sheriffs do not like to enforce, is any form of gun regulation.
They call themselves constitutional sheriffs. Are they beholden to the entire Constitution or just parts of it?
Well, they would say it is the first 10 amendments or the Bill of Rights. So that includes, for example, religious practice, guns, a lot of freedom to own private property, a lot of private property rights, and also state rights over federal rights. So moving away from a federal regulation, it does not include things like the 14th Amendment, which is the due process and equal rights clause. It does not include the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. They will add it does not include the amendment that adds federal taxes either.
Well, that's quite interesting because the 13th Amendment abolished slavery except for cases of incarceration. The 14th Amendment extended citizenship and made black people black Americans. And the 15th Amendment gave them the right to vote. And from what I'm listening to in your explanation, constitutional sheriffs don't acknowledge those.
They would say that those are not part of the original Constitution. Right? So this is how they limit themselves to the first 10 amendments. I mean, that said, I think that most constitutional sheriffs pride themselves on being something like, quote-unquote, race blind, right? So they would say, well, I would help anyone enforce their Second Amendment rights, regardless of their race, right? But I think what it practically comes down to, as you are properly pointing out, is that these constitutional sheriffs are not concerned so much with things like civil rights of people, equality. I think a lot of the things that we think of today when we say something like, oh, we are concerned about people's civil rights, right? Like the right of people to vote. And to that end, you can point to the longstanding constitutional sheriff xenophobia. So there is a great deal of anti-immigrant animus that constitutional sheriffs have, which they would say is about protecting the United States borders. But kind of also rounds down to something like racial profiling and wanting to assist with the federal government in deportations.
My guest is Jessica Pishko, author of The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Jessica, do constitutional sheriffs have any specific background experience and or education that qualifies them to be interpreters of the Constitution? Isn't that the job of the Supreme Court?
So I want to be clear that there is nothing that says that this is something that sheriffs do. It is absolutely not a valid legal doctrine. And a lot of the laws and ideas that they rely on have been like specifically struck down by the United States Supreme Court. So it's pretty clear that this is not something sheriffs have the capability of doing.
So can you give us an example of a constitutional sheriff whose name we might recognize?
Well, I think a pretty easy one to point to is a sheriff in Washington named Bob Songer. This might be familiar to some of your listeners. So Bob Songer is a sheriff in Washington State. He is one of the more original constitutional sheriffs. I think also I might point out the name Richard Mack, who comes up quite a lot in my book, someone Bob Songer is friends with. Richard Mack was a sheriff in Arizona. He hasn't been a sheriff for, I think, about 30 years now. And he is the individual who is widely credited with starting the constitutional sheriff movement and the largest association.
Well, when you talk about Richard Mack out of Arizona, when I think of Arizona, I think of Joe Arpaio. Is he a constitutional sheriff as well?
Yes. So Joe Arpaio affiliated himself with the constitutional sheriff movement and also met with Richard Mack. I think he blurbed, Joe Arpaio blurbed Richard Mack's book. So that's, you know, a sign of the fact that he approved. And, you know, Joe Arpaio was really important to Richard Mack and the constitutional sheriff movement because, as you point out, Joe Arpaio was so infamous, right? Like, I would say that however people felt about Joe Arpaio, they certainly knew his name, and they knew that he prided himself on being, right, sort of the toughest, the meanest sheriff. And Joe Arpaio also got a lot of press, right? And also fair to point out that Maricopa County, where Joe Arpaio was sheriff, is a much larger county with a lot more people, right? So he had a lot more people, money, weaponry at his disposal than many rural sheriffs do.
So to be clear, his audience of admirers were primarily white Americans, right?
I think that that's true. I do think that some people across the country admired him, you know, regardless, so I don't want to make a blanket statement. But what I will say is that the people who worked very hard to get Joe Arpaio removed were largely the Latino community in the area, including other, you know, sympathetic activists and people who worked on immigration issues. So, you know, it is fair to point out that as the demographics of that area changed, Latino activists spent a lot of time documenting Joe Arpaio's abuses, tracking his instances of racial profiling. And really, they were the ones who both, one, got Joe Arpaio voted out of office, and two, enabled the Department of Justice to bring their lawsuit against Joe Arpaio's office for racial profiling.
Can you talk about some of those abuses?
So, you know, Joe Arpaio is an interesting sheriff to talk about. So I think the thing he is most well known for was his racial profiling of people he thought would be immigrants. Joe Arpaio believed that he was entitled to, in essence, arrest and deport people who he suspected might be immigrants. So he spent a lot of time with his people. He also had a very, very large volunteer posse that he gave weapons and cars to. And so he and his posse would go out and essentially stake out businesses when they thought, for example, immigrants might be leaving work. There's one instance where I think he sat outside an administrative building and waited for people to leave work for the day. And then they would go in and arrest them and basically look to see if they were undocumented and eligible for deportation. I mean, beyond that, Joe Arpaio also infamously had a jail that he called Tent City, in which he kept people, including people being held who were awaiting trial, so they hadn't been convicted of anything, as well as people who might be awaiting deportation. So again, these are people whose, if they had committed any crime at all, they were merely being accused of perhaps being in the country undocumented. And these tent cities were very cool. They were hot, without air conditioning in Arizona. They weren't allowed to have salt and pepper. He served them rotten food. He would pipe in right-wing radio and force them to listen to it. And he really prided himself on that, right? He would hold up the, like, pink underwear he made men wear. He did a great displays of people on chain gangs doing road work, right? Sort of this imagery and display of cruelty. And I think it's important that beyond that, we also now know that Joe Arpaio was very bad at his job, in essence. So rapes went unsolved. He had very little interest in solving actual crimes being committed. And so I think that, you know, one can look at what he did and see that a lot of it was just a display of power, right?
Yes,
he would line people up just to be like, look what I can make people do.
So, Jessica, we were talking about the abuses of Joe Arpaio, the sheriff out of Arizona, Maricopa County. How large is the population of constitutional sheriffs, and how many jails do sheriffs overall control?
So there are about a little over 3,000 elected sheriffs in the country. There are a handful of states that don't have sheriffs, and there are a handful of appointed sheriffs. Around 85% of sheriffs run their county jail. So I would say the vast majority of county jails are run by sheriffs. Now, when we look at the constitutional sheriff movement, the numbers in and of themselves are not large. People think it's around 10% of sheriffs, so maybe 300 sheriffs in the country that specifically affiliate as constitutional sheriffs. That said, one of the arguments I make in the book is that the constitutional sheriff ideology is much larger than that. So there are a number of sheriffs who might not agree with all of the parts of the constitutional sheriff movement, and they might not call themselves constitutional sheriffs, but they do indeed believe many of those same things. So, for example, they may disagree with enforcing firearm regulations. They may not have enforced COVID rules and restrictions when those were in place. They might believe that they have more power to decide or believe that they don't have to let the FBI into their county if they don't want to. And I think among those, this is where we're getting into a quite high number of sheriffs, right? And you can see it when they testify in front of state legislatures. When states try to pass laws that say, well, we think that sheriffs need to be trained, or we think there needs to be certain restrictions on who can become sheriff, the sheriffs will say, oh, well, you can't put any restrictions on us or laws, right? Because we are the ultimate deciders of what's legal in our county. Because we are elected, that's the only way you can hold us accountable.
Well, what laws and authoritative institutions can constrain the whims of constitutional sheriffs? Who are they accountable to?
The sheriffs would say that they're accountable to their people, but that's not necessarily true, right? Because then you start to ask the question of what constituents, and this brings us back to the question of white supremacy. Who is it? Maybe not the people inside the jails, right? We could point to Joe Arpaio saying, well, he certainly didn't seem to think he was represented by the people inside the jail, even if they were his constituents. Among that, I think different states have tried other things. There is a small but growing movement to elect sheriffs with different opinions, right? So the idea of electing somewhat reform-minded or progressive-minded sheriffs is growing. So there are many places you might have people who are running specifically to counter constitutional sheriffs, and that's happened in many places, right? They get voted out. I think the second thing, short of sheriffs being removed because they have violated federal laws or have engaged in bribery, which has happened to a few constitutional sheriffs, indeed the FBI can investigate sheriffs if they break the law or engage in some kind of bribery or misuse of their office. The other thing is a lot of states are trying to pass laws that would require that sheriffs have to submit to certain kinds of checks on their background to make sure they don't belong to any groups like the Oath Keepers. This is actually not a law in any state right now. There's no state that requires that. Washington State is considering implementing background checks for sheriff candidates. They already have it for people who are deputies and police officers. And this is something that sheriffs have opposed mightily, right? They oppose the idea that if they want to run for sheriff, that someone should have to like go through their credentials and make sure they actually did what they say they did. And this is important too, just to bear in mind, you know, when we think about sheriffs and their deputies who commit misconduct, we often find out later either that they had their certification revoked or they had various misconduct complaints against them, because we know people move around. If there aren't background checks on people running for sheriff and they've been law enforcement, people who are voting for them might not know that they have been credibly accused of misconduct or disciplined for misconduct in other places.
Well, that makes sense. But as you talk about the election process as one way to replace these sorts of right-wing sheriffs, I'm reminded of a story you tell in your book about a county in Alabama that's 80% Black, and they had a white sheriff and had no way to use the electoral process to remove him. How is that possible?
In the South, it is a complicated thing. You know, the Black population in Southern counties have long tried to elect Black sheriffs. This is something that has been really important ever since, honestly, black men could vote. The first thing they wanted to do is elect black sheriffs that would represent them and, quite reasonably, protect them from things like the Ku Klux Klan. That was their sincere belief, was to elect police that would protect them when they did face sincere danger. And what we've seen over and over is that when communities, especially black communities, elect sheriffs that represent them, they are met with intense violence. I think many people probably recognize the post-Reconstruction violence that people faced, this incredible terror, right, imposed upon people and their followers, even imposed upon white sheriffs who were in favor of some form of civil rights. They would also get terrorized, killed, chased out of town. And we saw the same thing during the civil rights era in the 1960s, when black residents really wanted to vote for a sheriff to represent them. So not only does this system kind of work very hard to suppress change, for example, I live in North Carolina, and a few counties elected black sheriffs, and immediately the state sheriff association started to change the rules, because these were sheriffs who said, oh, we don't want to cooperate with immigration officials, we won't deport people, which is really important to their constituents. The state sheriff association said, oh, well, we can't do that. We have to make a rule that says you have to cooperate with immigration, right? So they have this ability to, like, change the rules when the people change. In addition to that, I think most people will recognize that there's a lot of problems with election and who gets the vote and how voting suppression works. So recently in Louisiana, there was an election in which there was a black sheriff running against an incumbent white sheriff. There was some sort of issue with some of the ballots, and the incumbent white sheriff argued that there was voter fraud. And this went all the way up to the Louisiana Supreme Court. The Louisiana Supreme Court said you have to do a do-over. You have to do the election again. And the black sheriff had won by a few dozen votes. They had to redo the election again, which, of course, was to the benefit of the incumbent, because it's very hard to get people to go out and vote again. Oftentimes, sheriff elections are not on cycle with other elections, so people don't know they're happening. Sometimes people don't know who's running. And then, as we now know, right, there's voter suppression. It is harder for some people to vote. People in jails, for example, are usually entitled to vote, but do not get to vote unless their sheriff facilitates the process. So you could be eligible to vote in jail, and if your sheriff isn't interested in helping you vote, then you can't vote.
My guest is Jessica Pischko, author of The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Earlier, you mentioned Richard Mack. Can you talk about Richard Mack and also Mark Lamb and Protect America Now?
So Mark Lamb is still the sheriff of Pinal County, Arizona. It's one of the larger counties. It's just south of Maricopa. It's like a largely suburban but growing county. And he, when he came into office, wanted to brand himself as a new style of constitutional sheriff. He started a group that he called Protect America Now. It was essentially a group of sheriffs that he knew who were largely right-wing, largely Trump-supporting, anti-immigrant, pro-gun, so most of the same qualifications. Mark Lamb also has attended Richard Mack's trainings and has affiliated with the Constitutional Sheriff Group before, so there's definitely some overlap there. You know, Richard Mack is getting old. His organization is rather old, and I think that Mark Lamb thought perhaps that he might be able to modernize it, get more social media savvy, with a lot more flashy visuals. Mark Lamb is a tall guy who wears a big hat, and so he will walk around in, like, cowboy boots and his leather belt and, you know, his holster and his black vest and sort of make a big show that he looks like a sheriff. I think I write in the book off. He kind of looks like a stereotypical sheriff. And so he uses that to his advantage to paint himself as this, like, all-American sheriff. Again, like things Richard Mack does, to paint himself as not political constitutional sheriffs, to argue that they are just enforcing the Constitution, which they would argue everyone should care about. But I think it's plain when you look at how they interpret the Constitution and what parts of the Constitution they value, right, that it is intensely political, right? It's intensely a far-right movement. There's no analog on the left, I think, and that undercuts their claim that they are, like, an apolitical force.
Well, you talk about Antonin Scalia's opinion. How did sheriffs get involved in this enforcement of immigration?
So sheriffs were not originally involved in immigration enforcement at all. But over time, especially throughout the 80s, when the drug war kind of legislation was at its peak, the federal government began to revise immigration law largely to make it easier to deport people that they thought might be suspected of being like drug dealers. And what we kind of developed was what scholars call crimmigration. I want to be clear, I did not invent that term. That's invented by immigration law scholars. And what they mean by that is that the immigration law, while it's a civil law, right? So if you are, let's say, in the United States and you've overstayed your visa, that's a civil violation. But what's happened is that those laws have become kind of like criminal laws. So you get treated like a criminal, by which they mean things like you get arrested, you get detained, often in jails, the same jails that people awaiting trial are detained in many cases. So you're treated in this way as if you've committed a crime. And as this happened, the federal government began to involve county sheriffs in this process, largely because sheriffs have control over the jail population, right? So the jail population are a group of people that sheriffs, of course, have control over, but also they're easy to check their backgrounds. So when you're booked and arrested, they take your picture, they take your fingerprint, and at the same time, they check your immigration status. So they look to see, you know, is your visa potentially expired? Currently, we have a system now where everything's computerized, so they can look to see, like, oh, are you wanted in other states? And then through that process, sheriffs can then contact ICE. Some of them have ICE agents in the jail helping them and say, we think these people are potentially deportable. And that sort of lends itself to the racial profiling, right? Because if you're a sheriff who is very concerned with immigration, what you can do is arrest large numbers of Black and brown people and then process them to see if some of them are potentially eligible for deportation.
Jessica, we're running out of time, and I really want our listeners to hear your conclusion in your book. So if you could just read that section, we have about a minute left. I'd appreciate it.
Of course, I would be honored. I'm going to read this excerpt here. This is definitely towards the end of the book. So beyond the history, sheriffs have not proven themselves to be responsive to the needs for community safety. One of the greatest harms of the constitutional sheriff movement, in my view, is how the politicization of the office causes sheriffs not just to engage in racist and sexist policing, but also these elected officials ignore core components of their job as defined by statute. They ignore missing and murdered indigenous women in the West, and crimes of domestic violence in rural areas where family violence is endemic. They refuse to serve subpoenas to people because they agree with their political philosophy, and as a result, treat members of militias better than victims of crime. And I'm going to skip a little bit, if you'll bear with me, to the end. So, you know, my point there is really just to say these sheriffs think they're following the law and representing their community, but in fact, we see that there aren't. And I go on to say at the close, a real reckoning of the myth of America requires a restructuring of our policing systems. We need to rethink who is policed and why. We need to reconsider the use of prisons and jails, and we need to acknowledge the value of human life and community connections. Sheriffs, while they claim to be community advocates, do not represent the whole community. In writing this, I acknowledge that there are many other aspects of local, state, and federal systems that require reform. The change isn't simple. But I think of what a politician told me when I explained the role of sheriff. Perhaps, he said, the sheriff is an office that has outlived its usefulness. To that, I might add that the sheriff did serve a purpose, quote, to keep the county white, as James Baldwin wrote. But that purpose is not one we should valorize or maintain.
Wow. You have written a very important book that I hope everyone will read. My guest is Jessica Pischko, author of The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Jessica, thank you for joining the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.